the first explanation in his studies on hysteria in 1895. The beginning of his text is the fact that his discovery obliged him to leave the usual scientificity, the academic Wissenschaftlichkeit, and to find a style, a way of writing analogous to novelists and to literature of folk tales. And this style would be, for Freud, the only way for creating a new theoretical discourse. It's the same thing here. It's not a positive science. It's a science of correlated subjects. And it's also the reason why there is a permanent importance of sexual differences, because if the problem is the difference and the relationship between subject, the basis of this difference is a sexual difference, and the difference between male and feminine experiences is a permanent symbolic or real reference to the for this literature. And it's the reason why I think this science may be specified as an anti-anthropology. You know that the anthropology was created in essentially in the during the second part of the 17th century and chiefly in the 18th century. With the possibility to constitute the human or social experiences as an object of science. For this mystical science, it's the contrary. It's a science based on the mutual instauration of subjects by their interlocution. And there is no possibility to constitute this experience as an object. It's also something which is interesting. You know that, for example, the essential point for Freud's theory is you can't elaborate a theoretical discourse without making explicit your personal position as a speaker. It's impossible to overcome this difference between you and your interlocutors. In a certain way, it's the same thing for Marx. For Marx, there is no theory of a history without making explicit the place where you are struggling. There is no overview or analysis of the history. And this science is a kind of a pragmatics of speaking subjects. But because of that, we may immediately specify some paradoxical situation of this science, the question of the relationship of this science with its methods. You know that a science implies the definition of an object and the definition of regular procedures, methods. In the case of this mystical science or literature, there are very sophisticated methods. It's a kind of mental technology. The first real elaboration of psychological technology for organizing your imagination, your spirits, the relationship with your body, a multitude of methods. But at the same time, there is an escaping object. It's impossible to specify the object. Or the only definition of this object is the fact it's escaping. It's the other, God, absolute. And when we are speaking of absolute, is to say without bound. There is no possible connection. It's curious to see this connection, the connection this science tries to create between so many technical methods and an escaping object, an impossible object. Methods, you remember, it's a kind of obsession in the 16th century with some very interesting feature. For example, the method is the first introduction of time as a matter of calculation. A method must be quick. The introduction of time as a possible object of manipulations. Method is also the contrary of an hierarchical ensemble of sciences, because the point is the possibility by a method to cross different fields. What is essential is the operation you do and not the place where you are working, the field where you are working. It would be the third element in a method. What is important is a human operation, the technique. And the final or one possible final feature would be the fact that a method must be efficient. The criterion is not the truth, it's the efficiency. In many mystical texts, you have, for example, this kind of title, a short or quick method for finding God, I suppose. It's making easy your conversation, the dialogue. It's to say you have the permanent impact of methods, but at the same time, this escaping object. And what will be interesting for us is the fact that in many cases, the poem is a substitute of this impossible object. Is a symbolic mask or substitution of God. And is a reason why so many times the treatise is a comment of a poem. The poem, but we will see the problem with Juan de la Cruz or many others, or the dream for Teresa de Avila or many others, it's a kind of a possible substitution of this impossible speaking object. A third determination is a question of method. I must be shorter. The question is, is there not exactly a particular method for reading or analyzing those texts? The question would be, is the way of writing in the mystical literature a point of departure for learning to read those texts, or maybe to find a general method for interpreting text? And what is typical in this literature is the fact that the language is used as the experience of speaking. It would be a language wounded by a voice, or by the search for a voice, because is this voice believable? It will be the question, but it's a kind of a postulate. And you know that in many cases, writing may be considered as the mourning of a voice. Substitution of speaking voice. We will see, for example, in the case of this little piece of the cloud of unknowing, that precisely the word is used as a work. It's not the expression of something which would be described by the text, but behind or outside the text. The mystical text is not the expression of something else, is the mystical act itself. The mystical text is a speech act, elaborating its own conditions of possibility. And consequently, we must recognize the mystical text as the experience itself of speaking, or at the movement of the mystical experience, or if I take a very frequent word used by those mystics, the text is the mystical operation itself. For us, we have some literary text, and this literary text is the phenomenology of the mystical search. There is nothing to look for behind the text. If there is a mystical experience, this experience is the movement of the text itself. There are naturally many mystics who didn't write A Silent Crowd, but we have some text, and their way of practicing this experience was a literary work. And it is a reason why I think we can't elaborate a kind of ideological definition of a mystical experience for recognizing it in a mystical text. If there is a mystical literature, the text itself must answer. And is the reason why we will analyze in those mystical texts the work, the mystical work itself, the work of this passion, the trace of this passion within the language. And the real term would be a mystical use of the language. Because essentially, the mystical experience is a question of use. If I take the term use with its Wittgenstein's status. And as an example, we may take just the little text I gave you on the cloud of unknowing, and maybe for the definition of a mystical text, we will see.
It's two sheets stapled together. Anybody have that?
Yes. Is it? I give you, it's one copy, the copy of the good edition of the Cloud of Unknowing by Phyllis Hodgson in the collection, the series of early English text society. I was sad and at the same time glad because looking for this book in Cornell's library yesterday, I saw he was no more in the libraries to say that there is someone reading this wonderful text. Maybe. and there are some English translation or transpositions of the text by Prokhorov or other people, and it would be a very interesting work to analyze the differences between the original text and those English interpretations. The first English publication was in 1582, and but the text was written in the 14th century by an anonymous author, but a very abundant one, who wrote also, for example, the book of the private counseling, or the epistle of prayer, or a translation, English translation of Dionysius, and many other things. And he lived between Rolle and Hilton. And the book, this little book, is essentially an exercise, is to say a method, for organizing deliberate concentration, but a concentration on something which is unknown. There is no clearly defined goal for this method. God is infinite, and the mental discourse mind is useless. And for the author, it's a very hard discipline in a search for darkness or cloud. The essential would be to forget one's own history and also scenes, activities, all your personal history is no more relevant. Because of a burning desire for God alone. Without trying to know what he is, the contemplative must realize to the full that he is. For only then can he offer himself wholly to God. There is a break between the knowledge of what I am, which is impossible, and that I am. Maybe it is the exact definition given by Wittgenstein on mystic. And the method is to organize what the author called a naked intent, which is the central point of the cloud. But my purpose is not to explain this wonderful, beautiful text. Maybe a very subtle English literary text. It would be sometimes when we read the text, it appears as a decadent text, like some English text at the end of 19th century, a very subtle conception of the English literature or literary value of English words. But my point is just to take in the chapter 7 something which is very surprising, and it's just a comment of my point concerning the way of treating mystical text, the fact that the cloud of unknowing is counseling to have only one short word of a single syllable in your mind. First, the question is a work. The goal is a work, the passage from the cloud of forgetting to the cloud of unknowing. The essential is to forget the multiplicity of your meditations and to avoid scattering. It will be, it is, the naked intent direct to God. And for that, there is a method. An exercise, like a poetic exercise. And the exercise is the reduction to one word. And is to say that this word, a monosyllabic word, it may be God in the text, it may be God, it may be love, but it may be work, it may be what we want. But only one syllable. The language is not taken as an expression, but as a linguistic or spiritual exercise. And there are many texts written by the same author explaining this point. There is a word for a work. It would be truer to say that the word is the work. But a word for losing the multiplicity of thoughts. Because it will be always the same word. In our language, the very trivial term, I love you. Love is so trivial. And it's the same word for each one of the interlocutors. And this little short word will be the creation of a relationship of innumerable feelings, events, with the same signifier. Maybe, for example, it would be possible to take as a comparison. You remember, but I forget it, in Citizen Kane, this little rosebud, this little word, which is organizing Citizen Kane's life, just a word, a signifier. And in our case, the word is not an expression, is an operator of unity. And it's interesting, it must be a monosyllabic word, a little word of a syllable. What is important is not the meaning. The text writes, choose whichever one you prefer. And there are many possibilities. It may be read, it may be work, it may be short, what you want. The essentially is the fact it is of one syllable. With this interesting statement, one syllable is better than two. And it will be the best tool for the work of the spirit, in the expression of the text. It's a formal unit, a question of form, is to say it's a poetic question. Or a phonetic question, and not a question. If we take, for example, the diagram given by Jacobson of the functions of language, it's a poetic function. What is essential is the fact that it's this word has one only syllable, a formal unit. Maybe there is a connection, and we will see that it will be the same thing for the relationship of Juan de la Cruz poetry with the Spanish language. In our case, this short word has a specific relationship with the structure of the English language. For example, at the same period, just a little later, Ralph Lever, for example, in the 16th century, in his Art of the Art of Reason, explained that for the most part of English words are short and stand on one syllable. And you know that there is a privilege of monosyllabic terms in the English poetry. There is also something which would be the relationship with alchemy, with a cabalistic theory, for example. Rochling or many others in the 16th century explained that the short words are preferable. And I have no time for quoting different texts, but here there is the coming back, for example, in this English theorician of linguistic Lever. It's interesting to take as a basis, linguistic basis, a short monosyllabic term and organize many combinations, which is a very interesting in his case. theory of the creation of new worlds.
Right.
But with the cloud of unknowing, we have the contrary movement. It's the coming back from polysyllabic words to a monosyllabic one. A gesture of returning to an original and fundamental linguistic unity. It's a rarefication of the language. Maybe you remember that, for example, for Yemslev, the linguistic feature of poetry is linguistic rarefication, linguistic scarcity. Here we have the same movement. But what is more interesting point in our perspective is the use of the monosyllabic word. And in the text, there is a struggle between he, what is he? He is a thought in your mind, or an intellectual representation. And the word is a way of struggling against those mental creation, production thoughts. And he is a kind of professor in your mind, something which is explaining, elaborating, discussing. And this he, a thought, an active force that rises in the mind, and which is also the tempter, the seducer, must be repulsed by this little monosyllabic word. It's a struggle between David and the giant. And the word is a weapon, a powerful word. And in the text, there is the explanation, the word is a shield, is to say a defensive weapon, or it's a spear. Is to say for an attack. What is interesting is the fact that shield, spear, are also monosyllabic words. The image is of a knight and a struggle. And the knight must beat and smite the thought, this mental personal of these scenes. And in this struggle, there will be, because of this little short word, the possibility to go beneath the cloud of forgetting. And my point is the situation, the definition of the word as an poetic exercise, and not, or the word as used, as a definition of a use, and not as specified by signified. And we in the text, for example, this little word will be the relationship between God and the speaking or searching subject, a little place of their meeting. And this monosyllabic word for the author can't be broken. It's a word, there is a beautiful expression saying that the world is not broken, ni undone. Undone, beautiful old English term, not is expounded, not explained, not analyzed. It's like a precious stone, and I take as status of this world the fact that the work is the world, and what is important in this not broken, ni undone world is the fact that it's a signifier of unity and a tool, a weapon, and not an expression. We will see that there will be exactly the same status of worlds in Juan de la Cruz or in Teresa de Avila or in other mystical texts. The meaning is forgotten because it's not the point. And is the reason why there is an essential connection between this mystical literature and a poetical use of words. But this use is precisely the practice of the theory. The theoretical status of the world may be found in the elaboration of those mystical texts. My point was to explain now what may be a mystical text, but there will be an Hitchcock suspense, and it would be interesting to have your suggestions and remark concerning your own interpretation of the mystical text. Just for ending this first short meeting, because we have the privilege to listen to Habermas talk on Foucault this night. Mm-hmm. Yes, and maybe it's not so far.
Not so far from mysticism?
From this poetical use of language, or theoretical. But a first view of our program. In principle, maybe in the beginning of the next meeting, I will give some elements concerning what may be as a first approximation, a mystical text. But essentially, we will read the Libro de la Vida, Teresa de Avila's Libro de la Vida, the question of the organization of a new autobiography as a literary mystical text. In September 26th and October 3rd, we analyze Juan de la Cruz Cantico, because it's a typical and a central example also. And in principle, on October the 10th, and Surin's experimental science and a poem of the same writer, with maybe some consideration of the possibility of specifying this literature as a fable, because a fable, I think, it, the discourse concerning the problem of beginnings, of a new beginning, of the principle. But it would be interesting for our collective work to have short presentations, if you agree with that, of a mystical text you know or you don't know. And maybe we may change our program relating your interest, because I think if there is a part of you interested, particularly interested by one specific text, it's possible to analyze it, not sur un or another one. Excuse me for being so long, and also for the meeting to be so short, but maybe finally there are some questions concerning the organization of our meeting, because I think it would be better, or maybe we may have until 4:15, or I don't know if there are some...
I just asked you to be sure to stop in time.
No,
break before Habermas.
Yeah.